You're listening to a download from North Sound 2. Listen again.
On digital radio, online and on 10:35 a.m.
Stained Glass Radio. On North Sound 2.
Welcome to Stained Glass Radio, that time in the North Sound 2 programme schedule when North Sound 2 goes just slightly spiritual round the edges. You know, I always listen to the news summary at the end of the show at 10 o'clock and catch up on what's happening in the world. And last week I was doing that. Don't you get the impression that sometimes they don't actually read the items before they put them out on the air? They were talking about Ryan Marnier, the Grand National jockey, who had an unfortunate fall from a horse in a subsequent race, and he was taken to hospital. But later on, they reported on his condition, and I was encouraged to hear our newsreader say that he was in a stable condition. Well, would you expect anything less? On tonight's show, there's even more value for money than usual because we have just not one, but two guests for you tonight. There's no thought for the week just for this week. Instead, we'll be talking to internet entrepreneur Kevin Mann, who was named as one of Bloomberg Businessweek's top young entrepreneurs in technology in 2010. And he's created a new Bible website called audacious.me. And we'll have a chat with him about that. Our main interview this evening, though, will be someone who's been in the news recently because he is the minister of an Aberdeen church that's left the Church of Scotland in the wake of the 2009 appointment of active homosexual Scott Rennie as minister of Aberdeen Queen's Cross Church. We'll be talking with Dominic Smart to find out what's been happening with Gilkenston Church since it seceded from the Church of Scotland and just what their plans are for the future.
On digital radio, online and on 10:35 a.m.
Stained Glass Radio. On North Sound 2.
Well, audacious.me is a new website that offers a new Bible reading experience. It has new features called Walks, Footprints and Discovery that visitors to the site can use to build on their experience of the scriptures. The site's creator is Kevin Mann. Kevin was named by Bloomberg Businessweek as one of 2010's top young entrepreneurs in technology, and he attended the TechStars program that same year in Colorado, USA, where he received mentoring support from major companies like Microsoft, Google and AOL. We're delighted to have him with us on the line this evening to talk about it. Kevin, welcome to Stained Glass Radio.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Kevin, how did you come up with the idea for this new website then?
It was a combination of things. The last company I had was a comic book company, kind of like iTunes, but instead of music, we were putting comic books online. Just before I went to San Diego Comic-Con last year, we were asked to do a comic book version of the Bible, and myself and the person who was working for me, Rachel, realized that we could do a whole lot more than just put a comic book Bible online. So we decided and kind of figured out what we wanted to do with God's Word and how we could get it out to more and more people. And then when I was at Comic-Con, somebody said I changed their life by giving them Spider-Man on the iPad, and I was like, wow. Imagine what we can do if we get this right and get God's Word out there.
Well, that's great. It's much more than a comic book online now. I mean, that's for sure. I visited the site. It's very impressive. What's the idea behind it? I mean, I know we said it was to help more people discover the Bible, but of course, there are other sites that do that. What's different about audacious.me?
Well, what we wanted to do was create an experience that was more of a shared journey of discovery. So instead of reading the Bible on your own, we wanted to create an experience where you could do it alongside other people. It could really become a community experience, a bit like how the Bible was when it was first shared. And we wanted to do it in a way that allowed you to then reflect how God's working in your life and not only share that with people on our site, but on your Facebook and Twitter feeds in a way that it's totally different from what's out there right now and create this really great experience that people who wouldn't normally look at the Bible or be exposed to God's Word can do. So that was really the vision behind it.
Well, it's certainly a very attractive site. It's quite elaborate and intricately designed, and it must take a fair bit of site management to keep it updated and fresh too. Where does the finance come from to do it?
We're a team of 10 people at the moment. We've been developing it for just over a year. People that invested in my last company, Graphically, were really excited by the technology behind the site. So They came on board and backed the project as well from a purely technological point of view. And then we had some private investment, a guy called Sir Peter Vardy, who is a Christian doing some really great work. He wanted to back the project as well. So we've got a mix of Christian and technology investors backing the project.
Yeah, I notice you've got some quotes from Sir Peter Vardy on the site as well. Tell us about Walks, Footprints and Discovery on the site. What are they?
The idea behind Footprints was that we wanted to create a way that helps you journey and go through the Bible, record where you've been. So if you're on John chapter 10, you can tag it in and say, this is where I was, and write some notes. And then other people can see that journey and kind of follow it along with you. And then we wanted to expand that with Walks, which allows you to like collect those footprints together and create this really personalized, beautiful experience of something that you're going through within the Bible or with God, and allow you to share that as well. So we really wanted to create something that was social, really easy to do. And when we get our mobile application out at the end of the month and the beginning of next month, we should start to be able to do that a lot faster and on the move as well.
And I notice, I mean, you mentioned that there's there's a facility on the site for studying, for reading the Bible and for interacting with the Bible. And it the version of the Bible you use looks like a paraphrase rather than a regular translation, doesn't it? Why is that?
We actually worked with a company called NavPress, and the version of the Bible that's currently default on the site is the Message Bible. It was the one that was most kind of accessible for people who hadn't read the Bible before.
I
but
see.
We have got the NIV going live on the site this week. Actually, it's on there right now, so people can see it, and it'll become the default translation in the week. It's the one that people most identify with. And we're currently getting the NLT version, and we've got about five or six other versions on the site as well.
Right, so there'll soon be soon people will be spoilt for choice. So what about the future then of audacious.me?
The future is about trying to get everything it all in one place. So things like videos and sermons, pictures and imagery, which we've already got on there. We want to really bring it together and make this really great personalized experience. So anybody who comes onto the site will find things that are relevant that can help lead them to the Bible. We don't want people to have to go to 10 different websites just to learn about the parable of the lost sheep in a way that works for them. We just want it to happen all in one place and gather all of the great ministry work, all of the great creative projects that are going on out there, and just bring them into one central spot. So we don't have to have tours around the internet to try and find something.
Oh, it's certainly a great site for anybody who wants information on a particular Bible topic, because it's full of audio links, video streams, and links to other sites too that can help. It's a tremendous research tool. Kevin, thanks very much for talking to us today. We'll give out the details again later on in the show of the site and where to find it. Kevin Mann, creator of a new slant on reading the Bible, I think it's fair to say, the website audacious.me. Thank you so much for joining us this evening on Stained Glass Radio. It's a pleasure speaking to you, and may God bless this site, and may it be useful to very many people.
Thank you very much. It was great talking to you. Thanks for the support.
On digital radio, online, and on 10:35 a.m.
Stained Glass Radio. On North Sound 2.
And thanks to Kevin Mann for joining us tonight and telling us about his brand new Bible study site worth taking a look at, www.audacious.me. www.audacious.me. All sorts of interesting things to find on there.
News from a Christian perspective. Stained Glass Radio News on North Sound 2.
Over £500,000 of public money has been handed to a controversial former government drugs advisor to carry out research into magic mushrooms. Professor David Nutt, who was sacked in 2009 as the government's chief drugs advisor, has said taking ecstasy is no more dangerous than riding a horse. Now Professor Nutt has been given £550,000 to investigate whether the active ingredient in magic mushrooms can help people with depression. Magic mushrooms, which are Class A drugs, have psilocybin as their active ingredient. For the trial, Professor Nutt wants to recruit 60 patients with depression who have not responded to two previous treatments. Half will be given a synthetic form of psilocybin, while the others will get a placebo drug. At present, Professor Nutt is struggling to start the work. He said, finding a company to provide this illegal drug has as yet proved impossible. He claimed laws established by the United Nations in the area were archaic and inappropriate for modern medicine. The money comes from the Medical Research Council and is given to Professor Nutt in his capacity as president of the British Neuroscience Association. But Mary Brett of Europe Against Drugs said, why is the MRC giving money to a man who had got it completely wrong over cannabis? Professor Nutt's patchy record raises questions. Professor Nutt was sacked in 2009 by the then Home Secretary Alan Johnson, who said he had lost confidence in his ability to give impartial advice. Professor Nutt's controversial claims about cannabis and ecstasy followed criticisms of government policy on drugs, including the reclassification of cannabis back to Class B. A consultation on highly addictive betting machines known as the crack cocaine of gambling ended this week. The machines have flourished in high street betting shops following Labour's liberalisation of gambling laws. Many critics say the machines are a key factor in the explosion in problem gamblers, particularly among the poor. The government is open to reducing the amount of money that flows through the machines, but first wants evidence about the harm being done. Fixed odds betting terminals allow people to bet money on virtual versions of games like blackjack and roulette. But because the machines are computerized, they are very quick to restart a new game when one has just finished. The consultation document on stake and prize limits by the Department for Culture, Media and Sport said it cannot ignore the persistent concerns from many stakeholders and local communities about these types of gaming machines and their potential impact on problem gambling. Don Foster, Liberal Democrat Communities Minister, wants a restriction of £2 a spin, the same as limits at bingo halls and casinos, saying there is no doubt these machines are ruining people's lives. Close to 1% of the population, 451,000 people, are addicted to gambling, an increase of 150,000 since 2007, according to a national survey. An Islamic cleric has cleared the path for rebels in Syria who are trying to oust President Bashar Assad to rape women as long as they are not Sunni Muslims. Salafi Sheikh Yasir al-Ajlawni, who hails from Jordan but who lived in Damascus for 17 years, sent a message via YouTube saying it's a legitimate fatwa for Muslims waging war against Mr. Assad and trying to put in place a Sharia government to capture and have sex with Alawites and other non-Sunni, non-Muslim women. Mr. Assad is part of the Alawite sect. In the video, the cleric called non-Muslim women by their Arabic term Milk al-Yamin, Human Events reports. The term is from the Quran and refers to non-Muslim sex slaves, Human Events says. Tens of thousands of Christians have left post-revolution Egypt due to concerns over rising Muslim conservatism and a general instability they say is emboldening attacks against them, according to World Watch Monitor, WWM. Perhaps the most dramatic example of sectarian tension yet occurred last Sunday in central Cairo, where a crowd attacked Christian mourners after they emerged from a funeral in Egypt's main Coptic Christian cathedral. Islamist President Mohamed Morsi has been criticized after the violence, which resulted in the deaths of four Christians, according to Associated Press. Egypt's Christians say they are easy targets when trouble erupts, and there is no system in place to protect them. There are no official figures for how many Christians have left Egypt since the revolution, although estimates range as high as tens of thousands. In Egypt's region south of Cairo, kidnappings of Christians are increasingly common. AP reports more than 150 kidnappings have been reported in the southern province of Minya since the revolution. And finally, in theory, if an atheist asked God to do something horrible, it would be meaningless to that person and not generate much anxiety at all. But in practice, atheists and religious people reacted the same way when daring God to do terrible things, according to a study in Finland. The study, which is to be published in the International Journal for the Psychology of Religion, asked 16 self-described atheists and 13 religious people how they felt about statements such as, "I wish my parents would drown," and "I dare God to drown my parents." Predictably, the religious people said they felt more uncomfortable about invoking God to do horrible things than the atheists did. But when researchers hooked all the subjects up to skin conductivity meters, they found something different. The skin test, which measures stress by sensing how much people sweat, revealed that the non-believers were just as bothered as the believers, even though an atheist ought to regard any statement calling on God to do something as meaningless, said the Wall Street Journal. No one is saying the test proves the old adage that there are no atheists in foxholes, but Trent Horn at Catholic Answers wrote, "I do think it's fair to say that tests like these could show that most atheists do not think God is a delusion, as Richard Dawkins argued in his famous 2005 book, The God Delusion." Stained Glass Radio News.
On digital radio, online and on 10:35 a.m.
Stained Glass Radio. On North Sound 2.
Well, last month, as you'll have heard on North Sound 2 News and on this show, Aberdeen's Gilcomston South Church left the Church of Scotland. The Reverend Dominic Smart and more than 300 members of his congregation objected to the appointment of openly homosexual minister Scott Rennie of Queen's Cross Church in the city in 2009. The congregation's been looking for a new home, and as reported at the time, it looked set to be using Aberdeen's Copthorne Hotel for worship, but that arrangement didn't come to fruition, and at the moment they're continuing to use Gilcomston South Church building by special arrangement with the Church of Scotland. Well, how are things going for the minister and his congregation in the meantime? How difficult has it been to cut ties with their parent denomination and strike out as an independent church? Well, to talk about it with us, we're delighted that the Reverend Dominic Smart can join us on the line this evening. Dominic, thanks for joining us.
Not at all. Thank you, Ken.
Dominic, the appointment of Scott Rennie to Queen's Cross Church in 2009, it caused a big splash in the, as far as the Church of Scotland is concerned. There's no denying that, and the tidal waves are still being felt. But at what point was it that you decided that leaving the Kirk was the only option for you?
I think, actually, it was more of sort of a growing awareness. I don't think there was a single point. After the Presbytery made the decision in 2009, January 2009, to approve the call by Queen's Cross to Scott Rennie, quite a number of us at that presbytery meeting dissented and raised a complaint, which is a sort of a technical process in the C of S. And that complaint eventually came to the General Assembly of 2009.
There were other churches complained as well.
Yeah, there were. I think there were about, if I remember rightly, there were about 22 people dissented after the decision was made. And about 12, 13 of us advanced the complaint to the General Assembly. And the General Assembly then decided to support Aberdeen Presbytery in its approval of the call. And set up a special commission to look at the issue of same-sex partnerships and the ordained ministry. And I think probably we were in Gilcomston, we were really waiting to see what came out of that special commission, which reported back in 2011. Mm-hmm. And so we spent quite a lot of time with special meetings, away days, looking at the issues involved during that two-year period from May 2009 to May 2011. And as that 2011 General Assembly drew nearer, we sort of worked out what the possibilities would be of coming out of that General Assembly and what our responses would be given the various sort of possible outcomes. And it was during that period, really, that we felt that if the church seemed to be advancing down the trajectory of accepting same-sex partnerships in the ordained ministry, then we couldn't really go there. And then, of course, it did make that decision in 2011, although some say that no decision was made, but I think that's not the way everybody reads it. And we felt, okay, that's it. We need to leave because we can't go down that trajectory as a group of elders in the congregation. And certainly as an individual Christian, I felt I couldn't go down that line either.
Well, you said that some people felt that no decision had been made. I mean, is that not a valid point? Because in next month, it's nothing's really ratified or set in stone, is it, until perhaps next month's General Assembly?
Well, I think that people maybe forget that during the 2011 assembly, the General Assembly did decide that it would raise no objections at all for ministers who were already ordained and had were already, you know, practicing ministers who were in same-sex partnerships, moving from one church to another, being inducted. So there was the approval of same-sex partnerships amongst those who were already in the ordained ministry.
I see. So in fact, what's happening is that ministers already who are already ordained in the Church of Scotland will be able to apply to be accepted as a minister at a particular church and be accepted.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. the process that took place in Aberdeen early 2009 with respect to Queen's Cross was sort of approved as something that you know, you couldn't really object to it. There were no objections could be raised in any presbytery, you know, from 2011 onwards. That is the process of a minister moving from, who's already ordained, moving from one church to another church, whether in the same or a different presbytery. Mm-hmm. So it really sort of rolled out nationally what had happened in Aberdeen in 2009.
Well, it must have been, I mean, when push came to shove and you had to actually leave the denomination, it must have been a difficult decision to make. But the support of your congregation must have helped, am I right?
Yes, I think so. I think, though, it's important to sort of get a feel for how things are in Gilcomston. It's a very strong fellowship in that there are very strong bonds and it really is a church family. And so it wasn't really a question of me making a decision and everybody supporting me. We really commonly felt right through the congregation and especially amongst the elders and deacons, the leadership of the congregation, that this is what we should do. So it really, you know, it wasn't me making a decision and looking around for everybody to support me. It was that we together felt the same about what had happened in the C of S.
Right. It says something for your, I probably says something for your type of ministry, the type of ministry that you do, though, at the church that attracts a congregation which is so so biblically based in their thinking. I mean, don't you think? Because at any other church, at many other churches, including Queen's Cross, they will, you know, obviously they will choose to accept homosexual ordination at the drop of a hat.
Yes. I think Gilcomston has as folk in Aberdeen will be well aware, who've been around for a long time in Aberdeen, Gilcomston has had a long, long history of expository Bible teaching ministry, and that's been around in Gilcomston for a long time, and it has always attracted a lot of people, young and old and everything in between, and continues to do so. Because I think that wherever you find the Bible being taught clearly so that people can connect what they can read for themselves on the page with what's being said from the front, and where it's being taught in a way that the relevance of it becomes apparent, you don't have to make it relevant, it is relevant, you just have to let folks see that, that will always do two things. First, it will attract people who find that really does connect with everyday life and helps them to get to know God and themselves better. So there's that thing. But the other thing is it does tend to unify people. And it does tend to give people a common basis, not only for you know, yes, we think this, and we think that, but they actually think the same way, using the same book as sort of the ground and foundation point for the thinking. So people will reach the same conclusions because they're thinking in the same way, because they're seeing it in the same book.
Yeah.
So it tends to unify a congregation as well as attracting very commonly thriving congregations.
Dominic, what about the rest of the Church of Scotland? You must have heard many people from within the denomination voicing their opinion, other ministers letting you know what they thought. What do they say to you? I mean, were many of them supportive of your decision?
We've had a lot of support for, interestingly, for the decision itself, but also for the way in which things have worked out in Aberdeen in our negotiations with Aberdeen Presbytery Special Committee and the way that, things have gone. So even people who have disagreed with the decision, other ministers in the Church of Scotland and well beyond the Church of Scotland, in fact, well beyond Scotland, people have written to say, well, I maybe wouldn't have done that myself, but I really respect the way that you've done it. Because what we've been able to do, and this is certainly with respect and with appreciation for the way in which Aberdeen Presbytery's Special Committee has handled things, what we've been able to do is to disagree without coming to blows. And the disagreement has been done with respect, so there, it hasn't produced a huge amount of conflict.
Yeah.
And so we found people, fellow ministers within the Church of Scotland, some folk from within 121 George Street, people out with the CFS, emailing, writing, phoning, saying, either we really agreed with what you've done, glad somebody's done this, or saying, I wouldn't have done the same thing, but I really respect the way that you've done it, and that has been, you know, good.
Well, that's good. That's very encouraging.
Yeah. I mean, I should say to balance that, we've had people emailing, phoning and writing.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You know, firing off both barrels and the usual sort of things come out, oh, you're a homophobic bigot, that
yes,
kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff has come out.
Get that from the, I mean, is that coming from within the church, that sort of thing?
We've had one or two from within the church and some from out with the church. And you know, there's always... you're always going to get that.
I mean, I was dismayed when I saw the online version of the Press and Journal talking about your leaving the Church of Scotland, and in the comments section, it was almost universally the worst type of vitriol.
Yeah.
I was absolutely ashamed.
I think it's interesting that I mean, you know, you don't take that, you know, to heart or anything, or you've been in a terrible state. But what it's shown, and many people in different situations will have found the same thing, is that the so-called tolerant society, because most of this is done by people who say you're intolerant, actually isn't tolerant at all.
Well, the definition of
toleration only goes as far as agreement.
The definition of tolerance has changed, I think, in recent times. We discussed this with a previous guest. You know, it used to mean, you know, putting up with someone with whom you disagreed.
Yes.
Now it means accepting that their point of view is perfectly valid,
that's
yours
right.
is. And it's produced a very strange way of thinking.
I think it's maybe even gone a stage further, and that is that tolerance has become a byword for demanding that you are agreed with.
Mm-hmm.
Not just that your view is valid, but that it must be acceptable. Mm-hmm. So even disagreement is becoming a problem.
Yeah.
And you get hate mail simply for disagreeing. Ironically, from those who champion the cause of tolerance. But there you go.
Dominic, you mentioned that you'd had very good discussions with the presbytery, Aberdeen Presbytery, about this. Testament to this is the way that they've allowed you to continue, they've allowed your congregation to continue using Gilkeson Church for the meetings. Mm. I mean, you were having some issues with finding a replacement place of worship, but you came to an arrangement with the Church of Scotland and you can use the building. But I'd heard, correct me about this, I'd heard that the building was the property of the congregation in any case. Obviously, that's not correct. How come I'd heard that? I mean, is that totally false?
It's because it's actually what everybody thought, Ken. We thought that within the fellowship, and legal experts that we'd spoken to thought that initially.
Right.
And people within the CFS thought that as well. I think that was originally the understanding of the church solicitor as well. But then, of course, you start doing the legal digging, and you have to work back through the historical documents that lie behind the present title deed. And it became apparent going back that actually what we'd thought was that the the local trustees who hold it, that is members of the Deacon's Court, held it on behalf of the congregation, who may at any one time be associated with this, that, or any other denomination. And they would take the building with them, with that sort of denominational association, so to speak. So the local trustees, the deacons of the congregation, held it on trust on behalf of the congregation. However, it became apparent from some historical documents, particularly earlier on last century, there was an allocation order which made it pretty clear that the trustees held it on behalf of the denomination for the use of the congregation.
I see.
So if you like, the triangle went the other way on. And that was, you know, absolutely crystal clear. The actual sort of weight that carries could theoretically be tested, or even by legislation could be altered. But that is so far down the line, would take so long, cost so much money, with no guarantee of any successful outcome, that really, now you got to take it 95% certain that actually we didn't own it in the first place.
Yeah. So, you had planned to move out of the church, and fortunately they've allowed you to continue.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you were planning to worship in the Copthorne Hotel, but something happened. What happened there?
Well, our first service of the new congregation was Sunday the 10th of March, and on the Tuesday, I think it was, of that week, we got a phone call from the management at the Copthorne asking for a meeting, a face-to-face meeting with them. So we went along, and it became apparent in that meeting that, in fact, they had received what we were told was a number into double figures of complaints and threats, presumably of withdrawing business, by people who were offended by Gilcomston's position on same-sex partnership in the ordained ministry. Whether those who had taken offence really understood the position, I don't know. But within the contract that we'd signed with the Copthorne, there was a clause saying that the hotel reserved the right to cancel bookings or cancel the contract if the views of those who were using the hotel were found to be offensive to other guests. And it was really simply that clause was put into action. It was a good meeting that we had with them, in the sense that it was cordial and very open, very amicable. And our, as a congregation, our real, the dunt that we took was not so much from the management and sort of falling out with the management of the hotel. It was more that they had been put under pressure by people.
Yes, yes. Something they would have found it very difficult to get around.
Very difficult indeed. Mm-hmm. And you know, they've got to make a commercial decision. It's a business. And their management have to make a career decision.
Yes.
And, you know, we fully understand that and felt something of the discomfort that they were made to feel. We came away thinking, well, you know, there you go, that's the tolerant society for you again, kind of thing.
Dominic, so what happens now then as far as Gilcomston Church is concerned? You've got a meeting place for the moment sorted out, but do you plan to continue as an independent church, or do you see yourself aligning with another denomination?
No, we very definitely will see ourselves aligning with another denomination, becoming affiliated to another denomination.
Do you have one in mind? The Roman Catholic Church.
It's really funny, Ken, because the week that it most recently sort of hit the papers about us leaving and all the Copthorne Hotel stuff and all that kind of thing, the next sort of religious story was Pope Benedict, you know, making way for a younger man. And because I'm called Dominic and I was leaving the Church of Scotland, people, you know, would be a very nice man, I'm sure. But
I'm sure.
My wife might have been a bit worried. Probably not the Roman Catholic Church, no.
Right, okay.
There's nothing against my own Roman Catholic friends. We're looking around. It's not a decision we want to rush into. I think we have a sense that Presbyterianism is something that it's kind of in our DNA, and you know, we haven't become un-Presbyterian in our thinking. So we're looking at a number of Presbyterian denominations, With two or three things in mind. The first is, it's up to them whether they would have us. We're not going to sort of announce, well, here we are, you'll be dead, please. It's nothing
sure.
like that. You know, if the decision will be the denominations to accept us or not.
Yes.
The other thing is that we feel that there is a way of doing Presbyterianism which is different from the way that Presbyterianism has become within the C of S. So let me just explain that.
Yeah.
What we have now in the National Church is a heavily centralized bureaucracy. We have top-down decision-making, that is from a General Assembly down, so acts of the General Assembly filter down and tell people what they may or may not do. We have a hierarchical system of courts based essentially historically on a civil model. And we have a decision-making process which essentially pits Christians against one another. So, top-down decision-making, hierarchy of courts, centralized bureaucracy, adversarial decision-making. Now, the problem is that if you go through the New Testament, you don't find any of that at all in the way that congregations are relating to each other. What you've got is something much flatter, much more sort of relational-based rather than institutionally-based. You've got something which doesn't remotely make decisions by setting people against each other in debates and votes, and that kind of adversarial system that has to prevail. So there's got to be another way of doing Presbyterianism. If the basic tenets of Presbyterian thinking are biblical, and in the Bible you don't get this massive institution, there's got to be a way of doing it which is flatter, probably smaller, fraternal rather than primarily institutional, and which is based on building one another up in the faith and supporting one another in the faith rather than conformity and compliance to the institution. So there are features of what the Church of Scotland has become as a national church, which I think as a fellowship at Gilcomston, we would not want to get into again.
Mm-hmm.
Because we think there is actually a different way of doing Presbyterianism.
Well, whatever church it is you're involved in, you know, you're obviously you're seeking a denomination, but one which binds the churches together with a light touch. Am I right?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think a light touch is right, and that necessarily probably means it's smaller and less bureaucratic and less centralized.
Yeah.
And much more fraternal. So, yeah, I think that's right, Ken.
Well, whatever you choose to do, as far as your denomination is concerned, and in the future of Gilcomston Church, Dominic, we wish you the very best. We wish you God's blessing on that.
Thank you.
Reverend Dominic Smart, formerly of the Church of Scotland, now minister of the newly independent, for now, Gilcomston Church, thank you so much for joining us this evening, and may... As I said, may God bless the steps you and your congregation are taking to remain faithful to him in spite of the obstacles and challenges that you've had to face in the process.
Thank you very much indeed, Ken.
Listen again to what you've missed and access exclusive online-only content at northsound2.com.